Chapter 23. That Nagging Discomfort. One thing stayed with Camoriel over the next few days, one nagging implication from his time with the illithid hive mind. Not from what he had learned, but from what he had not learned. Uwunavisk? The memories that particular illithid had added had struck him as odd at the time. Or not odd, perhaps, but somehow out of place. He knew what he had to do regarding Brevenden Margaster. He had to engage the man and force Asbiel to the surface, then somehow destroy the phylactery and intervene in the battle over the man's physical body. But there remained a problem, and one that could put him right in the face of a powerful demon if he could not resolve it and find an answer to a pressing question. Why had Wulfgar missed? The inescapable conclusion, particularly to a skilled psionicist, was that the barbarian's thoughts were being scoured, for surely Wulfgar was too fine a warrior to reveal the coming attack. How could that be, though? For Camoriel was connected to Wulfgar at that time, maintaining his kinetic barrier. He should have sensed any such intrusion. He had learned much about Asbiel and the hive mind. Asbiel was not really a demon, not a demonic incarnation, at least, but rather an elf, or he once had been. There was no indication of psionic powers, and even if there were, how could Camoriel not have sensed any such magic upon Wulfgar? There was an answer, one answer, but though it was glaringly obvious, Camoriel couldn't quite come to accept it. But he had to. He considered again the last memories imparted to him by Uwunavisk. Images accompanied by sentiment and words that were not unfamiliar to Camoriel O'Blodra of Loth's Menzo Berenzon. Familiar thoughts in an unexpected place. Shocking, even. Uwunavisk's contributions at the hive mind were nothing Camoriel had felt there, ever, even when the communal joining of the illithid community had been focused on Menzo Berenzon, House O'Blodra, or Lady Loth. Uwunavisk's manner of thought, a hint of the joy of not just chaos, but destructive chaos, was nothing Camoriel would have ever expected of the disciplined, always in control mind flayers. It reminded him of other experiences, Taurillian experiences. The words, the cadence of Uwunavisk's memory had come straight from the fane of the goddess, the most holy altar to Lady Loth in Menzo Berenzon. That alone wouldn't have bothered Camoriel so much, except that this particular memory wasn't related to Asbiel. He now understood that after taking so many hours in separating things out. No, this was an aside, an offered memory. No, that wasn't right either, not a memory. As he finally worked through it all, Camoriel had his answer. He put this in perspective to his own memories, ones barely shared with the hive mind. Terrible memories of the fall of House O'Blodra. That, too, now made more sense to him. He went to Wulfgar in his quarters with Bonnie Charlie and Dabney. "Now?" the barbarian asked eagerly. He rose from his chair and took a step toward Aegis Fang, which was leaning against the wall. "Not yet," Camoriel told him, "but soon. This day, if I return." "Where are you going?" Dabney asked. "Nowhere that concerns you, priestess," he replied. His voice edged with more than a little animosity, particularly with the memories of the fall of House O'Blodra so close in mind. He softened his visage almost immediately, though, and considered the possibility that, indeed, he would not return from his dangerous journey. In that event, Dabney might prove to be his best option. "If I do not return, deliver this message," Camoriel telepathically instructed her. He considered the best persons to whom he might offer such revelations. To Jarlaxle, he decided, then knew that this was not time for caution and changed his mind. "To Matron Mother Quenthal, to even Elbeenri. Yes, to them and only to them, but privately, and speak nothing to Matron Jindia Malarn, or High Priestess Osumtu Beenri." Dabney stared at him in confusion, an expression that only amplified as the moments passed, as Camoriel revealed his epiphany. He walked closer to her and lifted his hand, resting it gently on her forehead, as he gave her some memories and his explanation in tying them all together. He found the woman a willing vessel for such heresy, and only in that exchange did Camoriel understand the depth of Dabney's apostasy. Good, very good, he thought. You would have me tell these things to the matron mother of Menzel Berenzon? Dabney asked him incredulously. That way lies doom. She will make a drider of me before I have uttered a hint that will resonate. You know that I am correct in my beliefs here, Camoriel said. It matters not. Indeed, nothing else matters, said Camoriel. What are you two jawing about? Bonnie Charlie demanded. Nothing you would begin to understand, Camoriel retorted, without ever bothering to look at her. Perhaps you could persuade them by showing them as you showed me, Dabney said. That would be preferable, Camoriel admitted. But first, I must confirm my suspicions.
I thought we were going for Brevenden this day, Wulfgar asked, but Camoriel ignored him.
You have not even confirmed this, yet you ask me to speak with the matron mother? Dabney remarked, shaking her head. If I do not return, consider it confirmed, the psionicist told her. I do not understand, the priestess argued. What? Where? It is not your concern. Do as I instructed if I do not return this day. Tell Matron Mother Quenthal and Ivanel alone. No one else. I will need the assistance of those here to even find them, I am sure. And they will give it, Camoriel replied. But if they ask, they will not. He looked hard at Wulfgar and at Bonnie Charlie. Bregendierth will know that these orders came from me alone, and so they will aid you unquestionably and unquestioningly. And Jarl Axel? He will learn when he needs to know, Camoriel answered. Matron Mother Beanri and Ivanel alone, do you understand? Dabney nodded, and Camoriel took his leave. The exchange between Peskatawov and Camoriel was rapid and complete, for the drow psionicist accepted the great risk in allowing the most endeared Illithid into his deepest thoughts and reasoning. If he was wrong, if he had missed some obvious flaw in his reasoning, Camoriel understood that he would be destroyed without hesitation, for to make such an accusation against another Illithid was no minor charge, after all. Other races spoke of the value of family, but in the hive mind, such a notion went far deeper. Illithids were more than brothers or sisters or whatever, if any gender they might hold at any given time, as they defined such things far differently than any of the other races. As with everything among the mind flayers, the desires of the mind overwrote the limitations of the body. In the final note, however, the community was one. One. So to levy a charge against an Illithid, in this case a Wunavisk, was to point out a flaw in the entire Mind Flayer community. In a way, Camoriel had just privately called Peskatawov a traitor. I offer only my observations and memories of the fall of my house, he pointedly imparted when he felt Peskatawov pulling away from him.
I know what you offer.
It is her, Lolth, not a Wunavisk, he said aloud, thinking that they were less likely to be overheard audibly than telepathically in this particular place.
Your reasoning is not proven, but is sound, replied the Illithid in its scratchy voice, picking up on his cue. But why?
In his mind, Camoriel sensed the addition of House O'Blodra to the question. Matron Curel went too far in the time of troubles, Camoriel said. She threatened the order of the Lothian Drow. The ever-hungry infection that is Lady Lolth craved domination of the Illithids, but the Drow were her base of power in the place she most coveted, the material plane. He answered out loud, though of course Peskatawov had already felt that same reasoning within him. Camoriel sensed his doubt. This was the critical point.
Drow above Illithid. How could that be?
She could not have both at that time. But now she can, Camoriel answered, a response that was an epiphany both to him and to Peskatawov in that very moment.
Engage Uwunavisk now, the drow was told.
Camoriel took a deep breath, and followed the most endeared out of the quiet side chamber to the main area of the illithid castle, wherein rested the great brain of the community. Slaves of all races were in there, gently massaging the delicate and all-important brain, and many illithids moved about, some going to the brain to see what memories had been recently left for them, or to leave their own. Others were off to the sides, typically in pairs or threes, close together, and facing each other, their tentacles entwined in something that Camoriel had come to understand was either lovemaking or psionic battle, or perhaps a bit of both. Piscataway sent out a thrumming wave of energy, one that sent the slaves scurrying away and brought the illithids rushing to meld with the brain, the mind-flayer equivalent of a ship's bosun's call for all hands on deck. The most endeared held Camoriel back for a moment while all of the others settled in.
"Are you certain you wish to proceed now?" Piscataway asked quietly, for any telepathy now would be akin to shouting.
"More time will not help," the drow replied. "It will not help either my predicament or yours." His framing stiffened the back of the most endeared, reminding him pointedly that if he was right, the hive mind was in dire trouble here. Piscataway and Camoriel took their places, side by side, and with Camoriel right next to Uwunifisk. The most endeared was in Camoriel's mind immediately, using the power of the central brain to silence Camoriel to all others. Then, through the brain once more, the most endeared silenced all, except for Camoriel and Uwunifisk. The drow poured forth his thoughts, as he had privately to Piscataway, and with the speed of the telepathic transmission came the wall of denial and outrage from Uwunifisk.
"You work with agents of Lolth," he accused. "You were there with the attackers in Luskin, in the thoughts of Asbeel the demon, aiding them. You carry the desires of Lolth in yourself and bring them here to the community of illithids."
Uwunivisk's protests continued, but without conviction. One could not hide here and could not lie. It all happened in a matter of heartbeats, and then Piscataway opened up the floor to all. Camoriel had engaged in this communal expression of the hive mind many times in the past, but never like this. Never anything remotely like this. Swirls of anger and denial came at him, mixed with horror at the thought that what he had imparted could be true. He felt as if he were in a tornado, not a physical wind, of course, but a spinning of so many viewpoints that it left him dizzy and so terrified that he wanted to lift his hand and flee from this place forever. But he didn't. Camoriel Blodra had spent his life engaged in discipline, and he needed all of it now. He focused on one thing, long in the past, and showed the illithid hive mind in a running loop the fall of House Oblodra and the drow woman standing before the great house as it tumbled into the claw rift, her face a mask of ecstasy. Matron Mother Evanel Bayenri, Evanel the Eternal, the virtual avatar of Lady Lolth. The thoughts of the entire Colligate continued to swirl about him, jumbled, opposing, battling. The drow kept his focus and focused too on the illithid right beside him, Uwunifisk, who had no defense against the memory, indeed, who seemed appalled by it. Gradually, the swirl seemed smoother, one side growing louder. Camoriel knew the truth, and the illithids were confirming it. Lady Lolth was not a goddess, was not a demon queen. No, in this matter, to the perspective of creatures chasing the truth of pure thought, Lady Lolth was an infection. Uwunifisk was infected, diseased. The illithid had almost certainly unwittingly become the conduit of Lolth's newest attempt on the hive mind, one that was now ongoing. Before, it had been House Oblodra acting as the conduit to bring the infection of Lolthian chaos to this place, perhaps even Matron Curel herself. That attempt had failed, because during the time of troubles, when Lolth's minion drow, her beloved priestesses, and even the wizards of Menzo Berenzon had lost their magical powers, both divine and arcane, the ambitious Oblodrans had threatened the entire structure Lolth had spent millennia creating. Thus had Lolth failed. But the Spider Queen hadn't given up, quite the opposite. Now the clever malevolence, with the infinite patience of the immortal, had found an even more direct organism to come here and infect the central brain and, thus, the entire hive mind. All of the thoughts coalesced, the spinning tornado now a roaring hurricane, denying Uwunavisk's attempt, denying the physical being of Uwunavisk itself. Gamoriel felt the doomed Illithid's protestations, not a denial, but simply a plea for mercy. He understood it all now. Lolth was a goddess, perhaps, but also perhaps a demon, and a being with physical form. But she was much more than all that. A bit of Lolth was inside every reasoning being, usually dormant, but like a disease or an infection it could awaken. That should never have happened within the brain of a disciplined Illithid. It seemed utterly impossible. But it was not. Clearly not. There was little conviction in Uwunavisk's protestations, for even the Illithid now understood the truth. For the sake of the hive mind, Uwunavisk was there and then wasn't, driven mad, every synaptic pathway twisting and killed. From madness came emptiness, a continuing shutdown of the Illithid's mind. One last telepathic howl of horror, a silent shriek that shuddered Gamoriel to his very core, escaped the Illithid. The central brain cried out in sorrow so powerfully that Gamoriel was pushed back, his hand forcibly coming from the fleshy membrane, the contact sundered. He saw that he was not alone, that all the Illithids were standing as he was, dumbfounded, confused, trying to find some balance against the shock Gamoriel had given them, the horror Uwunavisk had been forced to reveal to them, and the overwhelming emotions of a central brain so suddenly made vulnerable that it had to destroy a part of itself, as if a drow were to bite off his own finger. Right beside Gamoriel lay the lifeless body of Uwunavisk, propped against the arching side of the central brain. "So it must be," Piscataway imparted to all. And that was it. It was over. Other than the slaves being brought forth to destroy the body of the inadvertent traitor. Gamoriel's work here was done. He offered that thought to Piscataway, and the most endeared excused him to go and tend to the more pressing problems he faced on his home plane, among his own inferior people. There was no sense of gratitude, no thoughts of hope that Gamoriel would succeed. It just was. There were a few moments like this for Gamoriel O'Blodra, when he almost reconsidered his life's journey, when he saw so plainly the difference between the sensibilities of the hive mind and those of Jarlaxle, his only friend. "Come at once," Gamoriel told Wulfgar. "It is time to meet Brevend and Margaster and be done with this."
"Now?"
asked the surprised barbarian. "Now," Gamoriel demanded. "Our enemy is vulnerable, but he likely does not yet know that one of his great advantages has been stolen from him."
"I don't understand."
"Aye, nor do I," Bonnie Charlie added. Gamoriel sighed. "Of course you don't. It matters not. If you were only included in things you truly understand, the two of you would spend your days doing nothing but drinking and rutting." Bonnie Charlie scowled at that, but Wulfgar laughed.
"Gamoriel told a joke. I thought I'd never live long enough to witness such a thing."
"If you tarry now, you'll likely not live long enough to tell anyone else about it," said the drow. "Now come along, and quickly." He held his hand out toward Wulfgar, then, as both humans approached, reluctantly held out his other one for Bonnie Charlie. She had no role here, Gamoriel knew, but perhaps Asbeel would kill her and thus waste a swing. The two took the offered hands. "He is in Shipkirth, a place I know well, and there is a room not far from the seat of power with which I am quite familiar. When I have prepared for instances like that before us now."
"Aye, like a wizard's glyph for teleports," Bonnie Charlie said.
"To put it in crude terms, yes," Gamoriel replied. "I know not what we'll find there in this moment, so weapons in hand and ready. I do not wish to waste my skills on mere underlings." That brought a snicker from Wulfgar. "You understand your role?" Gamoriel asked him. The barbarian nodded.
"One of them."
"That is all you will need to do."
"We'll see."
Gamoriel wasn't thrilled with the man's evasiveness here. He had told Wulfgar of his plans, of specifically what he would need from the man,
in order to perhaps decapitate the new order in the City of Sails. He knew that Wulfgar wanted more. Gimoriel had read that thought clearly during his explanation of how he intended the fight to go. Telepathically, he gave them a visual image of the room where they would arrive in Ship Kurth, and another more pointed warning that the place was likely occupied, perhaps even guarded. Barely had Wulfgar nodded to those imparted thoughts, than Kimoriel focused his mind keenly on that room, and in that focus he pictured himself and these two humans in that room. And so they were. And as expected, they were not alone. She was bluffing. She knew that as Matron Mother she couldn't show doubt. She was the voice of Lolth, after all. But Quenthel was full of doubt at that time. She wanted nothing more than to retire privately for a long rest, one in which she might yet again search the memories of her dead mother. Her previous meditation had led her to the one inescapable notion that she could not stop Jindia's victory, and thus she had to find a way to share in it. But could she? And worse, and more baffling, did she really want to? Her alliance was falling apart. She knew that without doubt. She had strong-armed the others to join her in this campaign, but as a foil to Matron Jindia M'Larn. Her impetus was to make sure that Jindia did not gain enough to threaten the order of the city. Few matrons would enjoy serving under the zealotry and viciousness of Jindia M'Larn, after all. But now Jindia had been given an army of Driders, brought back into existence by Lady Lolth. The retrievers had been a difficult enough sign for Quenthel to overcome. How could Jindia have been given those if not for the favor of Lolth, after all? But this development had all the others, even her two closest allies on the ruling council, Matrons Beertin Fay and Xerath Zor Lauren, glancing about nervously. The best Quenthel could hope for now, so it seemed, was to get them all in on a piece of the glory of this magnificent conquest. And it was indeed magnificent. As much as Quenthel wanted to deny that, she could not. It would be a reshuffling of powers back in Menzo Baranzon when this was finished, she knew. If she was lucky, Matron Jindia and House M'Larn would leap to the third house of the city. That would outrage Matron Xerath, of course. And it would shake those others loyal, or at least sufficiently cowed, toward House Bayenry. Matron Mesbaris would then no doubt quickly plot with Jindia to build a new and formidable alliance, one intent on displacing House Bayenry once and for all. Because if Jindia M'Larn became the most favored of Lady Lolth, how could Quenthel continue to claim the mantle of Matron Mother of Menzo Baranzon? And that scenario was if Quenthel was lucky. If not, she would be the matron of the city's second house the moment the drow returned to Menzo Baranzon, simply because the other seven matrons on the ruling council would unanimously agree that Matron Jindia's successes, so beautifully blessed by the Spider Queen, had to be recognized with Jindia seated at the head of the table. Could House Bayenry withstand that demand? And could they remain as second house much longer after that? All of that was the reason Quenthel now led the army, some 15,000 drow soldiers, priestesses, wizards, and thrice that number of goblinkin slaves, to the highest levels of the Underdark, to a cave that opened on the wide world above. They waited until that infernal fiery ball set far below the ground before coming out from under the sheltering stone. How far? Quenthel asked Sarabel Zor Lauren Doerden. She was keeping the two noble children of Matron Xerath close to her side, and indeed had put the whole of Xerath's house within the ranks of House Bayenry. Xerath had dozens of powerful wizards, after all, including the current Archmage of Menzo Baranzon, and Quenthel thought they might be needed, if for no other reason than to help expedite a hasty retreat for the two houses via teleport spells back into the city. Right behind that lead force came House Barris and Delarmgo, with Matron Mesbaris wearing a sour expression the whole way. For behind her came the other Bayenry allies. She knew the truth, Quenthel understood. Quenthel was putting her in a box that could create havoc upon her ranks in the first exchange if things here turned into a civil war. But there was nothing she could do to protest it, and that meant Quenthel still held the power. For now. Such a scenario was Quenthel's desperation play, though, and only in such dire need. She wasn't even sure if those matrons behind the Armgos would join in such an ambush. She wasn't even sure if Xerath would. If she was being truthful, she wasn't even sure if many of her own forces, particularly those under her sister Sosumtu, would. Sosumtu, above all else, was devout to the Spider Queen, her loyalties more aligned with Lolth than with House Baenri. She was a true believer, just like Jyndia Malarn. Sarabel conferred with her brother Ravel for a moment before pointing to the southwest. "The destroyed village is less than a day's easy march," she replied. "We could make it before the dawn if we hurry." Gwenthel nodded, but gave no such order. She needed to buy time here to sort it all out, to weigh the mood of so many of her fellow matrons, women who had spent their lives perfecting deception and duplicity. "Go to Matron Xerath," she instructed the two nobles, "and to Matron Mesbaris. Tell them that we will set a wide perimeter out on the surface. They can choose among their ranks no more than 50 soldiers, 2 priestesses, and 1 wizard. The rest of the sentry force will come from the other ruling houses." The two bowed and rushed away, and were replaced almost immediately by Sosumtu, Manolin Fay, and Mirinel. "Matron Mesbaris will send her weapon master," Sosumtu said. "No," Quenthel disagreed. "Not here. She doesn't fear for Malagdoral in battle, but he is too dim-witted to be the one to represent her if Matron Jyndia learns of our position and comes to parley." "Perhaps," High Priestess Sosumtu concluded, "I am to represent House Baenri on the front line?" "No," Quenthel said, and Sosumtu stiffened as if she had been slapped. Quenthel quickly continued, diverting the truth of her denial of such an honor. "No, I need you now. You speak with Lolth as clearly as any, save myself, and your counsel will be greatly valued as we walk the webs that have been woven here." "Perhaps Matron Jyndia speaks to Lolth most clearly of all," Sosumtu returned, and it was Quenthel's turn to be startled. This was the first hint of her fears coming to fruition. Quenthel tightened her face into a determined scowl and stared at her, trying to back her down. But Sosumtu was no minor player here, not even in the face of the matron mother of House Baenri and of all Menzo Berenzon. Sosumtu was mistress of Arak Tinalith, High Priestess of the Fane of the Goddess, and held a seat on the ruling council. Quenthel had given her that seat, adding a 9th to the table to bolster the power of House Baenri. But now? Matron Jyndia had been given 2 retrievers and hundreds of mighty Drider abominations. Did Quenthel dare to force the most devout Sosumtu to choose between her and the Spider Queen, the secular and the divine? Was blood thicker than soul? The room they appeared in revealed to Wulfgar how very confident Camoriel had been in Bregendierf's hold on Luskan. Normally wizards, and Wulfgar assumed the same for Camoriel, would set their prepared magical teleports, rooms speckled with Dwyamers, to make the journey more secure, off to the side. Small rooms from which they could come forth from the disorienting instant transportation in private and in safety. Not here, though. Despite some recent remodeling, Wulfgar knew this room, the large side hall of the main ballroom of the great ship Kurth. Now it was a bedroom, a barracks, and the 3 intruders hardly arrived in private. A table upended, and a trio of gnolls leaped to their feet, reaching for their weapons. On beds lining the perimeter of the place, more dog-faced villains stirred. Without hesitation, Wulfgar rushed toward the table. A small dagger flew past him, embedding into a gnoll's hand. As the creature reacted to block, it howled and ran for the door. A second missile chased it, a much larger missile, and the gnoll, even had it been looking, would find no defense against spinning Aegis Fang. It struck the fleeing gnoll square in the back, lifting it from its feet and throwing it forward into the floor, where it lay groaning. The 2 at the table lifted their weapon, short sword and cudgel, and grinned wickedly at the suddenly unarmed human charging in at them. Any feeling they might have had for their friend behind them inconsequential in the face of what seemed an easy kill. Wulfgar didn't slow. He also grinned back at them, which startled the gnolls. He went for the one with the sword, calling Aegis Fang back into his hands just before he reached his target. The gnoll stabbed ahead, not even realizing that its attacker had produced another warhammer. Wulfgar stabbed ahead as well, punching out with the top of his hammer, the heavy weapon easily intercepting the sword and driving it aside. The barbarian took a long step forward, right foot leading, turning his right shoulder ahead to further extend as he continued to stab, sending the gnoll skidding backward. He ducked his head in time, lifting his front shoulder to deflect the cudgel from the gnoll on his right. His arm went numb from the blow, but he fought through it and held on with that right hand, dropping his left as he turned behind the blow. As he went, he sent his numb right arm up and over the gnoll's extended arms, sweeping Aegis Fang up and over as well. Wulfgar spun about, reversing his feet and hips with a short leap, then burrowing ahead before the gnoll could fully extract its arms from his clench. He hit the creature on the side of its snout with a vicious left hook and let go as it stumbled backward, enough to buy him enough room to finish the rotation with his right arm, bringing it up before him and letting fly the hammer in a short throw that caught the sword wielder right in the chest as it finally managed to turn back to the fight. Wulfgar didn't watch the impact and had to hope it bought him enough time. He leaped on the gnoll he had stunned with the punch, again wrapping it more completely this time with his right arm. His left hand went to work, jabbing and hooking, cracking the dog-faced monster's jaw. It tried to pull back again, and Wulfgar let it, but only a bit, putting a clamp on its left wrist, the hand that held the cudgel, with a tug to pull the creature back at him, and as strong as it was, it couldn't resist the power of that pull. Wulfgar rolled to his right, slamming the gnoll in the chest with his left shoulder. He knew he was vulnerable to a bite if that jaw still worked, but he was confident that he would be quicker here. He continued to tug the wrist, straightening the arm, and drove his left arm powerfully over the upper arm, hooking it, locking it. With a suddenness, a brutality, and sheer strength the gnoll could not comprehend from a human, Wulfgar turned farther to the right and punched out with a hand clamped on the gnoll's wrist, bending the arm in a manner that arms simply shouldn't bend. The gnoll's elbow exploded, the gnoll howled in pain, the cudgel flew across the room. Before it even landed, Wulfgar released with his left arm, leaped high as he turned about, and came down from on high with a driving right hand, pounding the gnoll just under its left eye with such force that the creature seemed to shrink suddenly, as if its entire body simply contracted, and as Wulfgar landed and jumped back a step, that energy seemed to rebound weirdly, as if rising from the gnoll's ankles. It hopped from the ground and tumbled backward inadvertently, unconsciously, falling just out of reach of Wolfgar's ensuing left hook. It hardly mattered. The gnoll wasn't about to get back up anyway. But the other one proved a stubborn foe, and in it came again at the seemingly unarmed man. Obviously too stupid to expect the same trick twice, the gnoll came straight in for the kill, and if it became aware that the big man was once more holding his magical warhammer, it was only after it was too late to do anything about it. Both hands grasping the large hammer, Wulfgar brought it down from on high, cutting diagonally downward, crushing the gnoll's shoulder and driving through to flip the beast into a weird roll. It barely hit the floor before Wulfgar clamped a hand on the collar of its tunic, and up into the air it went, but limply, already quite dead. Wulfgar dropped Aegis Fang to the floor and cupped his hand hard against the gnoll's groin, then hoisted the heavy creature up over his head with ease as he turned, seeking a target. He noted a gnoll coming off its bunk. So fast and furious was his dispatching of the gnoll pair that this one had barely reacted to the unexpected intruders. Three strides toward it, Wulfgar used its companion as a missile, launching it hard, both target and missile tumbling back onto the cot. Wulfgar saw yet another gnoll coming in his direction. He thought to call his warhammer to his hand, but hesitated, noting Bonnie Charlie on this one's back. One arm wrapped about its neck, the other pumping her dagger into the side of the bleeding creature's neck, covering it in red liquid and filling the air with its blood. Off to the side, another fight raged, gnoll against gnoll, which confused Wulfgar only for a moment, until he noted Kamoriel off to the side, calmly watching, controlling his dominated puppet. Bonnie Charlie and her impromptu mount went past him, then crashed to the ground, and Wulfgar turned and nodded approvingly as his companion pulled herself from the dying beast. Good fortune had pulled him from the mesmerizing dance of Camoriel's surrogate fighter, he realized, for there was one more gnoll that he had not noted. It rushed out from behind a large footlocker, nearer to Bonnie Charlie than to Wulfgar, and charged at the woman, scooping up Aegis Fang as it went. Wulfgar yelled a warning and rushed to intercept, knowing he couldn't get there in time, knowing he didn't have to. He waited until the very last moment, the aggressive Noel bearing down on Bonnie Charlie, lifting the heavy warhammer over its head, then recalled Aegis Fang from the brute's hand. The Noel swung suddenly empty-handed and stumbled. To its credit, it rebalanced quickly enough to backpedal out of the reach of Bonnie Charlie's slashing knife. Wulfgar roared when the Noel started back at the woman, and it glanced his way and threw up its arms in panic, as if that would help. Aegis Fang hit it squarely in the face, throwing the Noel high and far through the air, and leaving more of the creature's head on the end of the warhammer than still on the Noel. A yelp from behind told Wulfgar and Bonnie Charlie that Camuriel's surrogate battle was over. They realized that the Psionicist's proxy had won, likely in no small part through the surprise its companion must have felt, for that victorious Noel was limping back toward Camuriel, arms by its side. Wulfgar thought to hit it with a thrown warhammer, both because it was a Noel after all, and because the Psionicist's enslavement of it offended him profoundly. He didn't make the throw, though, for the room's door burst in at that moment, and there stood Brevenden, or more accurately, Asbiel's contortion of the Margaster's body. Muscles bulging, skin deep red, bat-like wings sprouting from its back. Braylon hand signaled the companion down a side tunnel, confirming that he had seen the report of all clear along the way. It had been like that since they had run out of Illusk, moving through the same tunnels that carried the tendrils of the host tower to Gauntlegrim. They hadn't encountered a single enemy, or anything else for that matter, and so they were making great progress to the south, progress aided by the enhancements of Bianza Dosween, a wizard from a long-dead minor Menzo Baranzon house and the lone spellcaster in the group of four. The journey would normally take about 5 to 7 days at a swift pace, but because of the clear surroundings and the magical aid, Braylon's band was more than 2/3 of the way there before the second day. He should have been thrilled by that, but the idea that these tunnels were so empty concerned the veteran scout as much as it pleased him. There had to be a reason. And so there was, as Braylon learned soon after when Bianza Dosween caught up to him at a crossroad.
"The tunnels ahead are thick with drow," the wizard informed him. "I have cast my vision ahead."
"All the way to Gauntlegrim?"
The wizard shrugged. "I know not where the Underdark ends and Gauntlegrim begins."
"It doesn't matter," said Braylon. "It is Matron Jindia, and her we must avoid. Find a way for us to get up to the He paused, for Bianza was waving his hands and shaking his head, trying to interrupt.
"It is not House Malarn," he said, "nor House Hunsrin, their allies. I saw the banners."
"Which house, then?"
"Far easier for me to name the major houses who were not represented by the banners."
"Name them," a confused Braylon said.
"Malarn and Hunsrin," Bianza replied. "The others are all there in full force."
"Beanry?"
"Most prominent of all."
"Has the matron mother come forth?" Braylon asked, nearly choking from shock.
"Do you think me fool enough to loiter, or to move closer in my form with that possibility?"
"Of course not," Braylon said, collecting himself. "No, you did well. Gather the others and let us keep close together now."
"To the surface?"
Braylon paused, unsure. "We shall see," was all that he could answer at that time. Braylon's hand reflexively moved to the magical whistle Camuriel had given to him. He dropped it almost immediately, though, for Camuriel unnerved him, truly, and he understood that he should learn more of the situation to avoid prematurely summoning the frightening Psionicist.
"Prepare more spells of clairvoyance and clairaudience," he instructed,
"and any others you may have that can help us learn more of why the drow have come."
"Isn't it obvious?"
Braylon almost agreed, but as he considered it, he found that it wasn't obvious at all. Jarlaxle's conquest of Luskin and King Brunner's position in Gauntlegrim had all been accomplished without scorn from House Beanry, and indeed, Matron Mother Quenthal served to gain from the new arrangement. Thus, he had no idea of what was going on here, of why the tunnels were full of forces that should have remained in Menzo Baranzon. This disturbed him. Braylon was a disciple of Jarlaxle. He didn't like having no idea.
Kimoriel called upon everything he had learned at the hive mind in that critical first moment, all the while rushing behind a bunk bed to try to shield himself and not give Asbiel or Brevinden a clear enough view to recognize him. He focused particularly on the deepest thoughts of Uunavisk, the infected. Yes, he had understood that mind flare and its fall, for it had been lured by the same pattern of lies and descending stairway of little sins for personal gains into a hole of no return and no redemption. He used that now. As a drow who had grown up in Menzo Berenzon, he was well suited for the task. But this was a demon, an incarnation of evil. There would be no remorse within Asbiel, and no doubt, and so Kimoriel understood that he had to be near perfect. He reached out telepathically to Wulfgar, the man already rushing in to engage the demonic creature. "Let me in," he implored the man. If Wulfgar had hesitated in that instant, he would have been in desperate straits, but to his credit he trusted Kimoriel in that critical moment. Immediately, Kimoriel sensed his plans, his movements, and now reached out too to the demon possessing the body of Brevinden Margaster, and did so in the thought identity of Uunavisk. Wulfgar hadn't missed his swing on the boat. Nay, Asbiel had dodged because the infected illithid had acted just as Kimoriel was acting now, relaying the movements of Asbiel's opponent so that the monster could move with perfect anticipation. So now did Kimoriel, offering Asbiel an advantage. He could feel the pleasure of the beast. "You have been missed," he felt in response, confirmation that he had been right in all of this. Kimoriel projected a series of false movements from Wulfgar, but aggressive ones that would keep Asbiel on defense and thus not offer him a chance to put that huge, wavy sword through Wulfgar's skull. Wulfgar's next swing missed as the demon backed up and moved deeper into the room. "The door," Wulfgar said to Bonnie Charlie. He charged at Asbiel, forcing the beast farther from the entrance as Bonnie Charlie ran behind him to close the room's door. The barbarian pressed on, and the momentary confusion Asbiel signaled to the being he thought Uunavisk was answered by the demon itself, silently congratulating the human on changing his tactics in order to prevent reinforcements from coming in. "Who is this drow?" Asbiel did ask. "A witness from the powers of Menzo Berenzon to judge the Battle of Luskin," Kimoriel answered, thinking quickly. But the demon didn't believe him. The demon had seen him too clearly. The demon remembered him from the boat. The demon, no doubt through the vile work of the traitorous Uunavisk, understood the kinetic barrier Kimoriel had offered to Wulfgar in that previous encounter. Kimoriel had planned to goad Asbiel with half-truths about Wulfgar's intended movements, coming just close enough to elicit confidence before blowing the whole thing up and forcing the demon to turn left when it should have turned right. But now he felt the wall of denial, severing his influence over the body of Asbiel's slave, and Asbiel was no minor enemy. Wulfgar and the demon squared off on a level battlefield, and for the first time in forever, Kimoriel felt doubt.
"Stay back," Wulfgar ordered Bonnie Charlie.
He admired her courage, but her small knife wasn't going to do much against this demon with that huge sword. The woman backed from Wolfgar's side, and not a moment too soon as Asbiel leaped across the room, lifted by his wings so that he covered the distance easily. Wulfgar rushed sidelong to intercept, Aegis Fang and the demon's sword ringing loudly as they crashed together. A slight turn of Asbiel's wrist hooked the blade under the hammer's head, the powerful creature giving a sudden jerk then to try to disarm the man. Wulfgar tugged back, his great strength more than enough to match that of his adversary. He silently cursed himself, even as he won that embedded match, though, thinking that he might have used the opportunity to appear unarmed, the trick that so often worked to his benefit. He let the thought go, concerned with the moment, and tugged again violently to break Aegis Fang free, then immediately sent the hammer into a series of short chops back and forth before him as he advanced. Asbiel backed from the first, struck the second, and nearly lost his sword, and surprisingly, came forward for the third, accepting the brutal hit on the side to get up close to the man. Wulfgar was quicker than most assumed for a man of his size, and that saved him then, as he let go of Aegis Fang with his left hand and shot his arm out and up to tangle Asbiel's lifted arm
and prevent the demon from bringing his sword to bear. Now they clenched and struggled, Asbeel biting at Wulfgar, Wulfgar jerking the demon back and forth like a wolf snapping a rabbit's spine. He felt the sharp teeth of the fiend sinking into his cheek and howled, tearing his head back, then flashing forward with his forehead, slamming Asbeel in the face with tremendous force. The demon staggered backward, lifted his sword in both hands, and started to bring it straight down. But Wulfgar stabbed Aegis Fang first, the top of the hammerhead thumping Asbeel's face and driving him back too far for his downward slash to connect. On came Wulfgar, leaping, swinging, following through so that the warhammer came up and around over his head and right back across, one, two, three, and more. Asbeel continued its staggered retreat, Wulfgar barely missing with every swing. Wulfgar watched the demon's feet. That remained the most important lesson of fighting Drizdo Erden had ever taught him. Watch your opponent's feet. Because of that lesson, he saw and reacted to the intended counter coming before it had ever begun, Asbeel balancing himself to dart in high behind the next swing. Across came Aegis Fang, and down went Wulfgar to his knees, with a spin that brought the hammer across yet again, even as Asbeel's stab went right above him. He clipped the demon across the legs, flinging Asbeel over sideways. Wulfgar scrambled ahead and now had to let go with his top hand to press Asbeel back and keep the demon from reangling the sword. He had hurt the demon, he knew, and badly, but now Asbeel surprised him by letting go of the sword and punching Wulfgar on the side of the head instead. There was magic in that punch, which hit the big man more like the charge of a ram than any fist. Wulfgar fell to the side and crunched his own fingers under the handle of Aegis Fang in a desperate attempt to prevent him from falling fully prone, which would have been the end of him. He planted his trailing foot immediately and sprang away and heard the cut of Asbeel's sword right behind him. Scrambling, stumbling, he forced himself to his feet and around to face Asbeel, expecting the demon to be coming hard and fast. But no, Asbeel had barely moved and was now standing up very straight, with Bonnie Charlie on his back. The woman put her dagger to work, but not on Asbeel's neck, not on Asbeel at all. With admiration and fear for her safety, Wulfgar watched as she broke the chain holding the pendant and flung it toward Wulfgar, even as she kicked off the demon's back, lessening the punch of a spinning Asbeel, one that still sent her slamming into the wall where she crumpled and lay very still. Wulfgar set himself, glancing at the fallen pendant and back at the demon, trying to gauge his next best move. "Huh?" escaped his lips as he watched the demon, red-skinned and then not, horned and then not. Asbeel did take a step forward, but then fell back one. Wulfgar recognized an internal battle here, the human and the demon fighting for control with the phylactery thrown aside. He knew that he could run in and land a devastating blow on his enemy, but he remembered vividly Camoriel's instructions to him and the most important role he had to play. He lifted his warhammer and roared, then spun to the side and brought Aegis Fang down hard with tremendous force, shattering the gemstone.
From the moment Bonnie Charlie dislodged the phylactery, Kimoriel knew that the fight was his to win or lose. He threw his mental energy into the body of Brevidon Margaster like a javelin, jolting the man and the demon possessing him as surely as any physical weapon ever could. He had one objective with his initial attack, to separate the two warring spirits within that one body. As soon as that was accomplished, the moment he felt the struggle between Brevidon Margaster and Asbeel, Camoriel turned his attention to Wulfgar and breathed a sigh of relief that the violent man had followed instructions instead of his vicious and crass human instincts. In that intangible realm of the spirit, Camoriel sensed the destruction of the phylactery keenly. He knew that Asbeel would as well. So he went right back in, inserting himself into the fight between the two entities possessing the one body, and pointedly imparting to Brevidon Margaster the future awaiting him if he lost this struggle. There was nowhere for him to go, no phylactery to hold a spirit that it might fight another day. For Asbeel, to lose was banishment. For Brevidon, to lose was to die. Asbiel knew it and attacked the man with all of his willpower, hammering him, confusing him, driving him out once and for all. The demon did not want banishment any more than the human would welcome death. And because of that desire, Brevenden hadn't a chance of winning, except for the chance named Kimoriel O'Blodra. Kimoriel bolstered the man. Kimoriel led the counterattack, assailing Asbiel. It held for heartbeats, which seemed an eternity in the realm of pure thought. Kimoriel knew that he was at a disadvantage here and now, because Asbiel was already within the corporeal form, and Kimoriel was an outside attacker. He fought defensively then, bolstering Brevenden more than trying to weaken Asbiel, but he did throw one other possibility out there, hoping that Asbiel would grab it. Their spiritual battle was a spiritual connection, and so one that Asbiel could use to move swiftly behind Kimoriel into Kimoriel's body instead. While Kimoriel could join with Brevenden here in this body, Brevenden could not join with Kimoriel in Kimoriel's body. With no ground being gained and the expectation that the barbarian would soon destroy this body anyway, Asbiel made his move and found Kimoriel moving just ahead of him, waiting for him, letting him take the fight to Kimoriel's body. As soon as he fully broke his lifeline to Brevenden's body, Asbiel realized his mistake and Kimoriel smiled. Now Kimoriel had the upper hand. Asbiel was no minor foe, to be sure, but Kimoriel had spent a life learning the hive mind. To him, being surrounded by other minds was natural. To be overwhelmed by those minds would have meant madness or, more likely, death. Clearly, he had survived those minds, had thrived among them. And this was just one mind he now contended with. The spirit of Asbiel was a spirit unhoused, with only two options: banishment or possessing Kimoriel. Thus, in truth, Asbiel had only one option. The fiend's time on the material plane came to a swift and prolonged end. Wulfgar approached with the intent to obliterate the struggling form, but he was given pause, for the creature continued to shift color and details as the internal struggle continued. Then suddenly, it was a human, fully so. Brevenden Margaster howled in pain, grabbed at his broken ribs, and tumbled as his wounded legs would not support him. On the floor, he writhed and yelled and squirmed. Wulfgar looked to Kimoriel for guidance, looked across at Bonnie Charlie for hope. Neither offered what he desired. He turned back to Brevenden to see the man calmed, lying on his side, his right arm extended up in the air, palm out to fend off Wulfgar.
"Please. Please," he begged.
Bonnie Charlie stirred and sat up. That alone stayed Wolfgar's killing strike. There came a flash, then a last primal scream accompanying a ghostly image of a red-skinned demonic elven form, and then all three dissipated fast to nothingness. "Gather him," Kimoriel said from behind Wulfgar. "We need him, and we must leave this place now."